On this episode of Mechs and Men, Hans lays out the facts. Reinstag phones it in. Gina heeds the call, but Romano knows it's about sending a message. This is Of Mechs and Men, a Battletech book club. I am Kanan Hill, joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent.
It is me, Brent.
And Aaron.
It's me, Aaron.
How we doing, boys?
Well, I'm not being held at gunpoint by a bunch of Ginyosha, so I'm doing okay.
Well, that's good, because this week we're covering chapters 19 through 22 of the book we've been working through.
Warrior Coupé. By Michael A. Stackpole.
Let's get into it.
Chapter 19, New Avalon, 1st of June, 3029. This chapter starts, and we are in a briefing room with Hans, Quintus, Yvonne, Davian, and two other colonels. All right. They don't seem that important. There's some other guys here too. It's like a meeting. This is like a Davian meeting. This isn't Hans's office. He's gathered his brain trust into his briefing room. He's got some stuff. Well, Hans is, he's showing them the message that he received from the Primus recently, informing them of their, let's say, recent change in telephone service. Right? Hans has called this meeting to discuss, one, why have they been interdicted? And two, what are they going to do about it? Right? But you know, to answer your question from the previous episode, it looks like they did not anticipate this particular interdiction, at least. It caught them by a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah, they immediately kicked things off with talking about the Davian attack on the HPG station that we know Comstar had created. And they're like, we can see here in our combat vids that that unit was having a bad time. So they couldn't have done this.
I also like, we see kind of how insightful Hans is, right? We get this line, I get the feeling the Primus is a reluctant puppet, which is true, as we know.
You know what I liked about this part is that when Yvonne brings up, listen, there was that false flag video where they hit that substation. She just wants to, like, reaffirm the prince that if we had hit that substation, no one would have gotten away, right? Just to be clear, no one would have known about it. You know how we do. You know it's fake because there's a video.
And we can also remember that Yvonne Davian was the person that Hans sent over Morgan Hassock Davian's test results to. Who gave him like the glowing review.
That's did. Right. So why did we get interdicted? So at first they wonder whether maybe their recent military actions interfered with Comstar's business in such a way that they felt obligated to step in and do something about it, right? Maybe we were messing with the money, right? You know, maybe it's a money thing. However, that does not appear to be the case. And it is common to restrict access to communication facilities in recently conquered worlds for purposes of military security, right? You just don't let anyone make phone calls because you don't know who's a spy or not. So, and it's, you know, and it's not just them. We're just not the only ones who do it. Everyone does it. Generally, when you conquer a place, you don't just let anyone use the HPG because they could be sending anyone else anything. So if they were mad about that, this isn't even close to the first time. Just standard operating procedure. So that's probably not it.
I like Quintus Allard's theory. It's pretty sound. Comstar is a pacifist organization, and they may see a refusal to move our messages as an act of civil disobedience. He's not far off the mark, kind of.
You know, what's funny is, at the end of this little discussion, they're still not sure about it. They don't come to any definitive conclusions, but they do know that there is nothing they can do about it now. Right?
Right.
It's, we're in too deep at this point.
It's all just dealing with the fallout.
Yeah. I mean, Hans is left to assume that this must be some kind of move in some larger game that they just don't quite yet have a clear picture of. He's just left with the impression Comstar is maneuvering. And I don't know how or why, but that's just what this feels like. It feels like a maneuver.
This brings us to the preparations that Hans made specifically for times like these.
This is where Hans talks about the black boxes, right? So we've talked about these before a little bit, right? So on the table in front of them is this nondescript metallic black box, right? It's about square foot in length and width, about half a foot tall, right? Kind of a black little shoebox looking thing, right? These black boxes. What do they got? They got like a numpad on them or something. You get a little description in the text. Oh, so this is where we actually get to learn a little bit more about the black boxes though, right? Like they've been mentioned before, but we never really got any specific details about how they work. However, these black box devices, like this one, are the source of those mysterious faxes that we discussed previously. Remember the faxes that they've been receiving?
And like us, Comstar couldn't have predicted that the fax machine would make a return.
Yeah, no one predicted the fax machine. That's true. That's true. So yeah, that's how they can still send messages using these black boxes. Very simple, right? They are generally slower than the HPG communications, and they can only carry like very simple messages, right? No video or audio. But if you're just sending orders to the next planet over, they work quite well for that purpose, right?
Now, you can send video or audio. It's just not going to turn out too well. We're talking some real crunchy MIDI files.
Yeah, back in the LimeWire days type downloads.
Yeah, for that reason, they mostly only use picture and text.
It's like dial-up. You guys remember dial-up? Similar kind of a situation. Oh, you think it's making like dial-up sounds when the fax is coming through, like that old...
I assume that there's like a little tiny like satellite dish that pops out of this thing too. You know, it's real 2000s AF. Another thing though is, interestingly, they're mostly slower than HPGs. However, in shorter transmissions, they can actually be faster, especially since it's mentioned that Comstar will aggregate firings of the HPG and it can slow transmission speed. So in some circumstances, it actually can be more efficient, which is cool. These things are a cool bit of lost tech. Clearly, they don't know how they work, though, which is unfortunate.
Do you think they use like hyperspace technology? You think they are still like sending things through hyperspace, but at like over short distances?
Yeah, you're right, Kanan. The fax machines do use, it's not mentioned here, but they do use jump drives in order to send messages.
Kearney Fushida, KF forever. And up to this point, these things have been like real top secret. Right. Almost no one has known about the black boxes, but Hans kind of pulling them out. Right. He had a whole closet full of them and he's like, all right, guys, we got to break these out. Listen, don't tell anyone, but I've had these saved up for a rainy day kind of a situation. Like he even tells them that, you know, if your base gets taken over, you have to destroy this. This technology cannot be captured.
Yeah, this is one of those things that you can imagine. There's just a emergency white phosphorus grenade next to it.
In case of Capellan's pull pin.
Yeah. And then you pull it and it just calls in an airstrike on your location. Oh, you know, now Quintus is concerned that the interdiction will disrupt funding for his little pet project, right? You know, the insurrections. Remember the insurrections? Because if House Merrick doesn't have to worry about the rebellion, then they might start worrying about us. And that's the last right thing we need right now.
We're talking some classic Sun Tzu stuff. Divide and conquer. We don't want House Merrick getting in on this action, whether it be attacking the Capellans or assisting them, or just also fighting House Davion, right? That's the last thing that these guys want. So this is going to be a problem. Not being able to fund those rebellions is going to prevent them from being as effective as they would be. And those supplies are only going to go so far.
Yeah, right now, we got to keep the plan rolling of keep Merricks doing what they do best, which is fighting Merricks.
You know, Yvonne does suggest that maybe they could use Rizik to put pressure on the Free Worlds League, right? Let's give him a job. Let's say, hey, do some border raids. Get a little crazy. Let's have some fun. Cut him loose. And if they get really lucky, he might even die in the process. And wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, I love this part here when they're talking about it. And then they all think back to Arden Sortek's messages where he has not had a good time in the Tikhonov space. And he's referring to Ridzik as the littlest czar.
Yes. Yeah. They got a letter from Arden. Yeah, that's right. He calls him the littlest czar. Yeah, it is funny. You're right. We do get this part where we get this idea that Arden's just up there very frustrated, just like, God.
Just looking at a picture of his mech going like, I wish I could be in this thing right now.
He hates politics, remember?
Yep. But it seems like he really hates babysitting.
I don't know. He did a great job with Andy.
That's true.
Yeah, he's just like, man, remember when I fought that awesome? That was so cool. So since they can no longer rely on HBG communications, and remember, this does not only affect the military. This affects the entire interstellar nation of billions of people, right? So we can't use HPGs. That means the mail is going to slow down for everyone, right? This is like a big deal.
That is a big deal, right? Because the military, you can just be like, hey, we're not getting the mail anymore. Suck it up. That's an order. And everyone goes, salute and aye, sir, or yes, sir. But all of the interstellar merchant guilds and all of the, I mean, just merchants in general, just regular civilian logistics, any goods from just simple food that keeps weird mining worlds that don't have any farming operations alive, all the way up to luxury cheeses imported from other places and other luxury goods, right? So this is going to affect everyone. It's going to be a blow to the morale of this entire interstellar empire, right? Like, we're talking thousands of worlds that are not going to be happy, that are going to have to deal with anything from minor inconveniences to a huge disruption in logistics and having to maneuver around literally not being able to talk to people.
Yeah, we have to take a moment here and think of the horrors that the Federated Sun's communications office front desk is having to deal with. The number of emails. Well, I guess they're not getting calls, so.
Yeah. Man, this would be real rough if this happened to, like, everyone, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a problem, and we have to do something. Yvonne recommends pulling more jump ships from the commercial sector to use as couriers so that the troops can maintain contact with their families, right? Because to do otherwise, you would have a pretty detrimental effect on morale. That's not really something you can afford when you're in the middle of an invasion. You know what I mean? Yellow yeah. ribbons only go so far, right? You gotta get some mail, right? Because it is, if you think about it, especially affecting if you have loved ones on other planets. I'm sure that on-planet communication systems work fine, right? I bet if you're on the same planet, all the phones and stuff still work because that's not HBG based.
And there's probably even shorter, you know, relays between in system between ships. And we know that there's also communication, as it's mentioned, between jump ships, right, and planets. So they can act as kind of a repeater slash relay. But yeah, you're not talking to your neighboring solar systems, though. And by neighbors, I mean hundreds of thousands of light years.
Yeah, they need a plan. They're going to pull some jump ships, some commercial. They're going to contract some commercial jump ships and use them to move military correspondence and such. Crucially, Hans wants to do this while not restricting the general population's access to luxury goods completely, right? We can't just be like, okay, it's just hard times from here on out. You know, we're all eating beans, everyone, because then, you know, that's you're staring down the barrel of a proletariat revolution kind of a situation there.
We've been joking a lot about how House Davion's, just like a lot of the other successor states, they just hide it better. But this is one of the things that the Fed Sons do well, which is they are thinking about these things because they could just pull out the guns and be like, well, you're just going to do without and there's nothing you can do except fight me. But instead, he's like, Hans is literally like, "This, let's keep people happy and it's going to make us slightly less effective. But in the long run, people will bear with us better and we won't lose our own people to becoming a rebellious problem."
Small things, right? They can have some nice things. They just need to be selective about it. PS5s are fine. No Lambos, right? I don't want to see any Lambos rolling off a drop ship.
We're probably on PS 15s by now. Depending on how big Sony expanded, I imagine that there's multiple other people making higher gaming systems that are literally isolated to single planets. It's a crazy thing to think about. And if we kept going with this, it would probably derail the entire show. So I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's like the, I mean, even in the real world, there are secret gaming systems that were isolated entirely to a single country, like stuff that we never even heard about. True story. With like a lot of like weird homebrew stuff on it. What's that one from India? Like the Indian Nintendo. You're right. There'd be some wild stuff. Listen, if Pontiac is still here, why not Sony?
Sony's still around. Yeah, communication systems, the Sony MSF Tech 23 C3 used in the Yasha VTOL. So yeah, Sony's still kicking. They're a staple Korean company.
I like to think that Konami is still around, but it's just the health clubs. It's just the health spas, right? They haven't put out a Castlevania in 1,000 years, but the health spas are still cranking. So before we get out of here, there's one last thing we need to discuss, okay? We got to talk about the Certus Fusiliers. Am I right?
Listen, yes.
Everyone's heard by now how the 5th Certus Fusiliers got blown out on Sarna, right? They had a road game. They got blown out. It was nasty. So Hans begins the discussion by informing his colleagues that General Hearthstone has been captured and Hans has no intention of paying his ransom. We don't want him back. They can keep him.
They can keep him.
They can have him.
This is what I was getting at, right? They were sent here for a reason. And while he says it wasn't entirely intentional and that his hands were tied, maybe that part's true.
Oh, yeah, where he's like, and you guys won't believe it, but right after they left, I got a phone call informing me that McCarran's was on Sarna, and who would have thought? And it was just as soon as they pulled out the driveway.
What can you do?
Yeah.
It's funny because he's like, what could you do? But anyway, anyone that decides to work for himself instead of working for House Davion, they might end up just like the 5th Certus Fusiliers.
Maybe say a little, you know, say something happened to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's some real Don Hans Davion energy, right? He's like, it was an accident, but it could happen to anyone, okay?
He's like, listen, I didn't kill him. Send him to the planet. They could have won. That wasn't on me. But hey, what are you going to do about it?
What are you going to do?
He does go into, well, you see, the prince had received reports that the 5th Certus Fusiliers were considering taking part in some treasonous activities, shall we say. So when General Hearthstone demanded a mission that will allow him to avenge his duke, Hans made sure he got a good one, right? But yeah, Hans claims that it wasn't until they had already left that they received knowledge of the McCarran's presence on Sarna. Is that true? I don't know. That's what he says.
That's between him and Quintus, of course, I'm sure.
Big Q. Oh, also, to make things worse, Hearthstone was so eager to get started that he outran his support and walked his unit straight into a trap and got themselves nearly eradicated in the process. There were other forces en route, but instead of hanging out at the rally point and waiting for everyone to get together, he's like, nah, let's just go take it ourselves. And that's what happened.
That part we know there's some credence to, of course, because we got to experience firsthand the hover hell that the McCarran's Armored Cavalry threw at them.
I wonder if they made it off. I got to check the books on that. Like, how many survivors were, we know the general's still alive for now. Yeah. Yeah, last order of business. Hans ends the meeting by reminding us that the Federated Sons cannot afford to be divided at a time like this. And if you are not willing to stand with us, you will be discarded. Exactly. Maybe a little something happens to you.
Put some concrete blocks on the boots of your mech.
Drop it in a swamp.
You know, I think this confirms, you know, everyone's suspicions that there were more variables at play than just, well, who'd have thunk it?
Maybe. Yeah, he hits him with a take your fax machine. Just remember whose team you're on.
Yeah, but that's it. Just, you know, just a little catch up, interdiction, jump ships, black boxes. Don't mess with me.
I do love this chapter for how chill everybody is about the interdiction. Like, Mindo, if she was here, would be distraught. with everybody's like, we got interdicted. All right, here's your fax machine. Back to normal. No luxury cars are going to be shipped in. Let's move on. Let's keep beating the Capellans.
I do really like the parallel between the last chapter and this one, right? To Mindo's unhinged yelling, we have calm and collected counsel of all of the brainiacs, as you put it, all gathered in how to deal with the possible problems. And also, to the question I asked previously, I don't think that the events of this chapter completely ruin the possibility that Hans may have known. Again, I mean, he literally lies at the end of this chapter. Well, possibly lies at the end of this chapter. It's very possible that he did see this coming. However, we'll never know because he planned accordingly, right? He planned for all of the worst outcomes. And so the reasons everyone's calm is that they have options, right? They're not in a corner here. Because they prepared for winter, obviously the ideal options are out the window now, but they've got backups. So things are going to be okay. The hit isn't going to be as hard. It's going to be hard, but not as hard as it would be if they had not planned.
Dude, these black boxes came in clutch though, right? So grateful we have the black boxes. But yeah, I like that immediately we get the Fed Son's response to the interdiction, which is like, all right, people, we slowing down? And they're like, nah. And they're like, cool, let's keep trucking. And that's it. And you're like, all right. You're right, Mindo literally crying right now. That's a good point. They were expecting, like you know that, yes, in her mind, they're like in here, like, we can't believe it. It's like, this ruins everything. It's, you know, it's done. The war is over. We're dead. But instead, they're just like, that's all right. Check this out. Got one of these. It's going to be all right.
Got four of these boxes here. This is what Tieplo was concerned about, right? He warned everyone multiple times every time Mindo brought this up. Remember, the whole reason we do this is because we can keep listening if they're sending messages. We know what's happening. And now, in some ways, House Davion is even more dangerous to Comstar because now they can't monitor their mail.
They had to do something. He's a madman. On a revenge quest. We have to slow him down somehow. He's not going to stop until he's taken everything. Man, they did it though. I mean, we are post-interdiction. We've been worried. It's almost funny where it's almost anticlimactic, where the whole time we're like, oh my God, what if they got interdicted? We'll see how it shakes out, but the temperature is, we're going to be all right. Like, well, that's kind of funny. But yeah, this kind of meeting, this whole interdiction business, obviously this was telegraphed way ahead, right? This was two forces that, you know, we knew that it was only a matter of time before these lines intersected.
And with Hans being let off the hook, we'll have to take a ride into the next chapter.
Chapter 20. We are on Ride in the Lyran Commonwealth, and it is the 6th of June. 3029. So this chapter is all about this poor young Lieutenant Reinstag, right? Joachim Reinstag. Apparently, the Lyran forces currently stationed on Ride, the local garrison, they detected a couple of dropships landing on planet, right? They had some sensor readings and they've sent a guy out here to investigate, all right? Lieutenant Reinstag, he's out here with the radio. Yeah, the chapter starts with this poor guy on the radio calling back to base, trying his best to explain to his commander what's going on out here. And what's going on out here is a company of Karita mechs with strange markings out here moving rocks around. That's what he's looking at.
I wonder what that's about. Also, shout outs to this dude's call sign Eagle One. That's fun for all you hell divers out there.
Yeah, it's just a crazy thing. He's like, well, I don't know, sir. So his commander asks if it looks like they're building a fortification. Are they trying to dig in? What's going on? But Joachim doesn't think so, right? He actually thinks, and this is what he tells his commander, he thinks that they're building a replica of the Battle of Mallory's World. And his commander reasonably wants to know why the fuck he would think that.
There's some red flags here.
Yeah.
He's got a radio back in. He's like, you didn't read Hell's Anvil?
Dude, that's exactly what he says. He's like, oh, I read Hell's Anvil. And his commander's like, by Jay Mitchell? I heard the last third was heavily fictionalized. No, that's not actually. He does. He totally says, sir, I read this book about it once, and I think this is like a replica of Mallory's world. And the commander's like, what? Like, excuse me?
The commander's like, so you're telling me you read some Caridan book and now you can think like some kind of Caridan?
Yeah. This impressive display of insight on the part of Lieutenant Reinstock is shocking to the commandant, considering that Reinstock once reported an abandoned mine as an enemy base. So he's come a long way, right? He's just like, you read a book? Like, since when?
Joking aside, these should be some red flags, these interactions. And it is kind of funny that the commander just kind of goes along with it. And as it turns out, thankfully so.
This is where Joachim pleadingly to his commander, really, he's like, sir, I really think that we should just leave them alone, okay? They don't look like they're doing anything bad. And also, they brought more than enough weapons to completely destroy us if they wanted to, right? If they aren't bothering us, then we probably shouldn't bother them.
Yeah, that's how wars work, right? You just don't have to fight.
You know, I say live and let live. But given the numerical advantage and the fact that it's a small militia possibly having to be mustered to fight the Genyosha, it's probably good that things are panning out this way.
Yeah, it would be a lot worse if they were like, nah, we can take them.
Yeah, the commander honestly like really respects that Reinstock would like stand up in this situation. We can tell that he's being surprisingly stern. All of a sudden, he's got strong feelings about...
Damn it, Reinstock. When you get to my position, I hope to hell you have a recruit like yourself in command.
I love that line. He's like, yeah, man.
You've come a long way since calling out mines as operating base there. Maybe we'll trust you this time.
It's real funny because it turns out this is probably one of the most terrifying moments of this man's life.
I did want to say, I love when Reinstock tells the commandant, he's like, listen, they're minding their own business now, but if they wanted to take Ride, you'd be telling me about them, not the other way around. And that was funny. Like, he'd be getting a call like, hey, we're under siege, right? Like, that's what he's trying to tell him. He's like, man, if they were going to attack, this call would be very different. Just so you know, they don't look like they're doing anything.
They're just moving rocks.
Yeah. But yes, as Brent said, we learned very quickly that maybe he isn't as relaxed as he's making himself out to be.
Yes, the flop sweat's well earned.
But he totally convinces the commandant, though, right? He tells Joachim, okay, keep an eye on it. Report back if anything changes, okay? Eagle out. So the commander hangs up, much to Joachim's visible relief. And I love this shot, right? At this point, I feel like we like get a little zoom out and like the camera pans up and we see that Akira Brahe has been standing next to Joe the whole time holding a gun, right? And this is so funny. I love this is a classic. I really do. I love like the zoom out and you see like the gun barrel and then we see that it's Akira. This is great. But Akira just tells Joachim that you did well and we should be finished soon. Oh, however, Akira does tell Joe that he's going to send him back with a holo disc, which Joe is to hand over to Comstar to send to the Kellhound. Right? He's got a message for them.
However, he's not to watch it himself nor allow anyone else to see it as well.
Very personal. Not safe for work. The chapter ends with Akira telling Joachim that he's very happy that he was here because if he wasn't, they would have had to destroy the city. And you're like, oh my God, right? But good point. Really, like Joachim's presence here kind of saved everyone. They're never going to know. That's what he says. He's like, these people are never going to know, but you being here and kind of like calling off the dogs kept us from having to kill everyone. So good job, Joachim.
I'm sure he's just tickled to help.
So this is Ride. And this is where the Kellhounds and the Genyosha were supposed to meet, right? That was the whole thing, is that they missed each other where they kind of, you know, one was Northwind, one went to Nishira. Oops. Then, you know, the Kellhounds did all that stuff where they messed up the base and they moved the stuff around. And then, you know, the Kellhounds are going to meet them at Ride, but then they got turned around. They had to go back and save New Freedom. And so they're going to miss the date. So then the Genyosha showed up here and the Kellhounds still weren't here. That's what's so funny about this, is that this isn't even the first time this has happened. They cannot, like, get this meeting to work. I mean, How many mysterious messages have they left for each other at this point? They're leaving another one. This is just what they do now. It's like, all right.
I like that now they're not leaving anything up to chance, though. We not only did we do the rock thing, we also left a holodisc.
That's all I could think about when I finished reading this chapter was like Yorinaga sitting up on a hill like, no, that rock needs to be further to the left like it was on Mallory's world. And he's just so excited. Morgan's going to show up. They're going to have their big fight party. And we know where Morgan is. And it's not on ride.
I like that no one knows what's going on except for those two.
Yeah.
If Morgan shows up and sees this, he's going to be like, yes, yes, of course, I see. And everyone's going to be like, see what? Like, what is this? This is like, everyone is confused at this point. This thing has been dragged on for so long. God, will they ever meet? Like, will they ever get this destined meeting? We missed it again. Frustrating.
I mean, we are only on chapter 20. There's 54 of these bad boys plus an epilogue.
Good point. There's still hope.
Yeah, we got plenty of time to stack rocks and communicate with each other throughout this book.
I was going to say, like, so yeah, this long plot line, though, that has just been kind of simmering in the background since the first book, still unresolved, right? We were like, oh, are we going to kind of see some kind of resolution of this? No, not this one. Not this time.
And with that, we've had one tragedy avoided by some Lyrans, and we'll have to find out if there are any more in store in the next chapter.
Chapter 21, Tharkad, 20th of June, 3029. We're back on Tharkad, and this chapter starts with Misha and Gina hanging out in Melissa's bedroom, right? Misha still doesn't know, right? She thinks she's hanging out with Melissa. The girls are hanging out. Misha is here to review some footage that Simon had asked her to take a look at. Remember, they mentioned that before, about how Misha was able to glean all this information off of, like, very little output. And Katrina was like, ooh, I should hook you up with Simon. So apparently she totally did. Misha's been tasked with going over these news reports, giving it a discerning eye, seeing if they're saying anything that they don't mean to be saying, kind of a, you know, informational security. You know, what's funny is that the footage they're reviewing, it's actually a news report about the recent trouble on Lyons, right? That whole thing we went to with, like, the new freedom. It's like a news report, like, you know, informing the public that, you know, something occurred on Lyons. I know it's hard for Gina to watch because she knows Dan was involved. You know, he was in the fighting. He was in danger. He got shot up. It stresses her out to watch it. She's like, oh no, I know this one. That's where Dan got shot.
It's a credit to Gina's abilities that Misha, who's been a friend of Melissa for most of her life, is still remaining fooled by her. It's very impressive.
I like that it has like a voiceover. I feel like it has this old-timey kind of newsreel kind of vibe where you're actually getting footage of some of the Met combat, like some holo footage, and there's like a outraged by the Karita strike on his innocent village, Captain Daniel Lallard fights back. And it's like him and the wolfhound. And you're like, oh, a voiceover. That's cool.
Regardless of the weight difference, he surrenders to this enemy mech.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got this real like wartime newsreel kind of a vibe to it. I'm like, all right. Now, they're watching this video. However, they don't get very far into it before they are interrupted by a servant knocking on the door. Because apparently, a captain from the Davian Light Guards has requested a word with Melissa. Misha gets really excited when she hears this because she knows that's Andy's unit. This guy must know Andy. So they go out to meet the guy in the parlor, and he introduces himself as Captain Bailey. Okay, this is Captain Bailey of the Davian Light Guards, ostensibly. However, immediately after introductions, like immediately, they don't like have some kind of conversation, and over the course of this long conversation, things are slowly revealed that don't add up. They're like, hey, how you doing? Hi, I'm Melissa. I'm Misha. And immediately after introductions, Misha notices something odd. She asks Captain Bailey if he's new to the unit. And, well, he claims, oh, no, no. I've been with the Light Guards for 3 years now. And Misha asks him, well, okay, but if that's true, then why isn't he wearing the Saint Andre ribbon, right? I love this. He's missing the ribbon, dude. This is so battle tech, though, right? It's like, oh, you don't have the ribbon from that battle. I mean, it's just only Misha would notice this.
Specifically because of our boy Andy, right? I imagine she doesn't know all of the proper awards for different units around the Inner Sphere. Though as a historian, maybe she does know a few. This one in particular is, you know, because of her relationship with Andy.
So Gina, after hearing this, immediately obliterates this dude's face on her knee and takes his gun, right? As soon as Misha's like, "Weird, you don't have a St. Andre's ribbon," Melissa's like, boom, just crushes this dude, or Gina, should I say, and takes his gun. And Misha's like, what? She's freaking out. Right.
I feel like because it's comical. I mean, well, it's comical to us, but I imagine it would be quite shocking, even regardless of Misha's discovery, for this to be the way Melissa acts.
Yeah. She just was like, "Where's your ribbon?" And he's like, "Oh, that's funny." And then Gina knocks his teeth out.
Kapow.
Yeah. And, like, she like reaches down and gets the gun. She's like, "Good. Mauser and Gray M27 needle pistol." Oh, she even checks the breech. It's got a fresh block of polymer in the chamber. She's like, nice. This reminded me, we talked about the needle pistols recently, and I was like, oh, it's funny that they mention the ballistic polymer right here. When she is like, oh, look, there's a little block of polymer. I was like, oh yeah, we just talked about that.
I also think it's interesting this thing has a breech, because it probably doesn't have something that it ejects, but it does make sense for there to be one. There will be a way for it to see that it's loaded and to clear jams. So I thought this was an interesting bit of data we got about the needle pistol here.
Yeah, it's so surgical. It's so efficient. Misha's just like, what? Like, what's going on? Why'd you do that? And like, she's just like, good, like full magazine. She's like, huh?
I want to say that I don't think the fact that she took these actions is probably shocking, but the fact that Melissa is the one doing them, well, not Melissa. But remember, Melissa was trained as an infantryman. So it's not entirely unusual that she could take these actions. It's just, why?
Yeah, Misha's freaking out. And Gina's like, look, listen. I realized that this guy doesn't have spurs on his boots. Look, no spur, right? But we all know that, like, Fed Sons mech warriors always wear rowless spurs. That's their thing. We've talked about this. He doesn't have spurs.
Feddies love their spurs.
Yeah, this guy's a fraud. Like, between the lack of the spurs, the proper ribbons, and the presence of an extremely Lyran heel click maneuver that he did, that also she noticed. She's like, why did he do that heel click? That's a Sanglamor thing. Oh, right. And even when she investigates his person, she uncovers a Sanglamor sash, meaning that this guy is from the Isle of Skye. So that means that if this guy's a fake, then the officers meeting with the Archon right now must also be faked, which means that the Archon is in danger and she probably doesn't even know it.
And this is probably one giant assassination plot.
Yep.
I mean, there's no way to know. They did deal with the threat very efficiently, and so can't exactly question the guy right now.
But we had a few chapters that have given us a heads up on who be implementing this strategy.
The reader knows, right? Dramatic irony has done its thing.
I like this. Is Gina looks at Misha and just goes, the Duke must be trying to kill the Archon again. Right. Not the first time.
No, this will be the fifth time.
Yeah.
Hey, at least he's not a quitter.
Yeah, he's not a quitter. He's just a loser. But we got to save the Archon. We got to do something. How do we get to the Archon? We got to get to her office. She's in danger. We got to go fast. Gina expresses frustration that there is only one way in and out of that office, right? But this is where Misha mentions the secret passageway behind the bookcase. Gina didn't know about the secret passageway, right? But when she asked Misha to tell her about it, Misha is confused, right? She doesn't understand, why wouldn't Melissa know about the secret bookcase? They used to play in there all the time when they were kids, right? Don't you remember? Don't you remember the secret passageway? No, of course, no, Gina doesn't know, right? Melissa never showed her the secret passageway. However, Gina knows that they have no time to waste, and she commands Misha to please show her the way.
This is a bit of an oversight by security and the Archon and this whole body double thing. This seems to be an important and key part of protecting Melissa and escaping in the event of some unsightly attack just like this.
It does say they were mentioned in some briefings. Gina's aware of them, but she never explored them or like learned them very well. So she doesn't know where they all lead. I think she knows like a few of the entrances and stuff.
And to counter my own argument, I can imagine that it would be a security risk showing her them, because it would be unusual for someone to be showing Melissa these passages, as she should already know.
Misha doesn't get it. She's like, this is weird. You're acting weird. What's going on? It's at this point that Misha thinks, like, maybe Melissa is, like, kind of losing it. And maybe she should just call Simon, right? She's like, hey, you're just freaking out right now. Maybe we'll just call Simon. She's like, no, we're not calling Simon. And she's like, okay, we're not calling Simon. Gina points her gun at Misha and tells her that she will literally shoot her if she does not help her, right? And this, of course, it doesn't work. Misha's like, I'm sorry. Like, then she starts freaking out. And she's just like, show me the passages. Show me. Like, she's like, what's wrong, Melissa?
Melissa, you need help.
Gina literally did everything she could to prevent having to disclose her cover. But it seems that that's going to have to be a requirement to go forward here.
Yeah, she's like, I need the guy in the face. Took the gun. Man, I'm really running out of options. Didn't know about the bookcase. Oh, man. Sorry, Misha.
Right. Yeah, Gina, she realizes that this ain't it, Chief. You know what I mean?
Aaron, are you alluding that this is a bit of a Grayson plan?
No, I feel like Grayson opens with those. There's like forethought and everything on a lot of those things. This is something where like Grayson sweep kicks and then just runs away. Gina tried to talk Misha into doing this the way she needed to do it. And Misha was just like, I think you might be having a psychotic episode, Melissa.
Fair enough.
Grayson would just be like, where are the maps? I need to see the maps. But yeah, this ain't going to work. And Gina realizes that, yes, she's going to have to tell Misha who she really is. Here we go. So Gina explains that she is actually Melissa's body double and that Melissa is actually on New Avalon with Hans Davian right now. I'm not Melissa. I'm sorry. I've been lying to you the whole time.
She does make her play this weird game where she's like, why do you think it would be important for her to be there?
Yeah, and Misha's like, oh yeah, breeding. She's like, exactly. Exactly. Right. At first, Misha doesn't believe it. But after she thinks about it for a moment, she realizes that's a pretty good idea. Come to think of it, it is funny. Misha, to her credit, when she just give a second, she's like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, body double. Okay, this totally works, by the way. She's just like, I'm a body double. Yeah, I would say, to Misha's credit, she doesn't freak out. She really is like, oh, this makes sense. All right, then. And I'm like, oh, cool.
Makes a lot more sense than Melissa pointing a gun at her. The truth goes a long way sometimes.
Because she's like, come on, stranger, we can get to this bookcase.
Yeah. So Misha demonstrates that there is, in fact, a secret passage behind the fireplace in Melissa's quarters. And it'll lead, if you know how to follow it and where to go, you can take this to the Archon's office. However, it is very narrow and dark, and they will have to walk like in single file, right? Gina will have to go in front of her. And so, yeah, they both like squeeze into this little passageway, and they kind of shimmy along. You know, they're inside the walls, trying to find their way to the Archon's office. Oh, we do get a moment when Gina's going through the tunnels. She's thinking about her father, right? Do you think this is how he felt? Remember that night on Polsbo where he attacked the comm tower to create a diversion so that Katrina could get away, right? Griezen, he worked for Heimdall. He was Gina's father. She's thinking about her dad while she's going to the thing. Like, is this how it felt, Dad, that night on Polsbo? I was like, yes, never forget Polsbo. So eventually, Gina emerges from behind the bookshelf into the Archon's office, much to everyone's surprise, especially the Archon. Right? It's like they just see Melissa kind of emerge from behind the bookcase with a gun. And the Archon's like, Melissa, I knew this was happening. Hello, we do this all the time. And she's just like looking at her like, what are you doing? Now, Gina makes absolutely no attempt to explain herself before raising the pistol to the two officers and reciting the motto of the Sanglamor Academy, right? It's sick. She just points the gun at them and she says, they have like this unofficial motto. She says something that these guys would recognize. Oh, what is it? Oh, yeah, Exodus Acta Probat, as the Duke was fond of saying, it's over. Bailey, spoil your plans. And they immediately react to this, right? She gets them. They're like, oh, we've been had. And the two men go for their guns, right? Immediately, they start scrambling. And unfortunately, they are too far apart for her to be able to get in one shot, right? They're separated. And they're like, They're going for their guns. Isagenia's like, I can't get him in one. No time. It's fine. Just hit the first. Just shoots the first guy. Just misses this dude. Right. Just boom. Just needles the like kills him immediately. Right. Like pulls the trigger, shoots the first guy. Gina manages to move her gun over in time to shoot the other man in the throat, killing him, but not before he is able to take a shot of his own, right? We don't even, she's just like, I feel like all of a sudden Gina's on the floor, right? She's just like, she shoots both guys, but like the next thing she knows, she's like on the floor. She's like, you know, why am I on the floor?
We get this first person death scene, which I think is both brave and bold of Stackful to do, and I think he executed it so well. A wave of darkness stole her sight. Then she found herself slumped on the floor. She saw her gun lying centimeters from her right hand, but her body refused her order to grab it. As if to mock her effort, she rolled onto her back and lost sight of the gun. Gina tried to swallow, but couldn't. Must have been hit hard. She felt a trickle of blood pool in the hollow of her throat. Shouldn't there be more pain? This was wild. The first time I read it, I was like, oh, we find out that Gina dies in the first person.
Very sad.
Yeah. And to have Gina die here, because especially this chapter kind of comes out of left field. There's not a lot of setup to it. We know about the plan to try to assassinate Katrina again, but it's just far enough away to be out of your mind. So when you get here, you weren't sure which arc Gina was going to be on, where everything was going to come together. So her dying here really feels like it comes out of the blue.
And it's paced so quickly, you really don't have time to kind of like think about everything that's going on here. Yeah, it is very sudden. I immediately like felt bad for Dan. It was like my first thought. I was like, oh no, poor Dan's not going to handle it. Yeah, he's not going to handle this well. I do wonder, she says the Latin phrase and they go for their guns. And I do wonder if maybe if she had just started blasting, maybe she could have got both of them. Or maybe if she had her Sanglamor sash, you know, maybe she'd still be alive. But then maybe we would have lost Dan.
Good point. She didn't have her sash. Now, Captain Bailey had his sash, and that didn't go well for him.
Yeah, but he's also not dead.
Good point.
Oh, Aaron, that's a very good point.
She gave away her sash, and Gina Clade dies on the floor of the Archon's office. And that's the end of Gina's story. That's, remember, the whole body double thing from the beginning. Let's get this body double. And she gets, you know, remember the scene, she's like jogging, she's like on her morning jog, and she comes home and she's talking to her neighbor, and she gets, you know, attacked in the bathroom and captured, and she meets with the Archon, and she says all that stuff about how she's so willing to sacrifice herself, how she would throw away everything in service to the Archon. I mean, she did it.
She did. I did not expect her to go here on my first read through. It was set up so well that I was like, this body double thing is going to be something that's exploited for some time. But no, just these books.
Well, and I like how Stackpole even set us up for it in the first book when Gina's having the conversation with the Archon, where she's like, there is no life for you after this. This is like a terminal position. And yeah. Gina's like, I'm here for it. That's absolutely what I want. I want to repay your family for the life I've received.
It's really the only solace that can be found in this, really, is that at least she died in a way that she maybe would have wanted. We kind of even get that call back to her father right before it happens, which I'm not going to lie, that moment is like a red flag, right? It makes you a little, you're like, huh. It adds some tension to what's going on.
So now two members of this family have sacrificed themselves to save Katrina Steiner, like both of them anonymously. Right.
Right.
Unsung heroes. Misha comes in the room. She sees that Gina is dead. Katrina asks Misha, when she looks up and sees Misha there, she asks her if she knows the truth. Right. You know, don't you, that she's not Melissa? Misha explains what happened, how Gina had to tell her so that they could reach her in time. Right. So they could reach the Archon's office. Katrina understands. So Misha asks the Archon, what do we do about this? This is kind of a sticky situation. We got this body that everyone thinks is Melissa. It's not Melissa, but like Melissa's supposed to be here, but she's not actually here. And now her body double's not here. Like right away, Misha's like, we got to cover this up. We are, or something. What do we do, Archon? And Archon's like, listen, You guys are about to go on vacation anyway. We'll keep it all hush-hush, black box the palace, no one in or out. And Katrina tells her that what she wants Misha to do is travel to the Federated Suns and bring Melissa back home. So Melissa's coming back. We got to get her back. I will say, this part was surprising. Yeah, man, you don't expect Gina to get killed like this. This is one of the most shocking deaths in the whole trilogy. I still think about this. When I would think about these books, I'd be like, oh, where the body double dies. It's sad.
I really do think that first person perspective is the thing that makes this work so well, because the tension is kept all the way through to the point that you even think she's successful for a moment, right? Because she downs both guards. And so for a moment, you're like, we're safe. And you share the shock with Gina as she collapses.
Yeah. Well, and especially because on the Bethel raid, Justin gets shot with a needle pistol and pulls out of it. So you think, oh, well, maybe she's just blacked out here. And it isn't
right, even then,
that next sentence when the Archon's closing her eyes that you're like, oh, she's gone.
Poor Dan.
She was a hero. Gina Clay. Never forget Gina, dude. Best body double of all time.
She did her job, right? Melissa's still alive, and because of her actions, by extension, the Archon is as well.
God, this also presents a challenge. Now we got to get Melissa back here. Remember the first time? Remember when we tried to get her over to the Federated Suns? It was a whole situation. Patrick Kell died. I was like, man, here we go. You know, part two. Let's see if we can get her back. Silver Eagle part two on the way. No, she'll never fly with Monopole again. Am I right? Ram trap.
And we had to say goodbye to a hero in this chapter, but we'll have to check in with a villain in the next.
Chapter 22. We are back on Sion. It is the 25th of June, 3029, and it's a party, right? Sion's popping off, by the way. We got fireworks going, people in the streets, and we open with Romano, like, in her room, right? Looking out over the city and just being like, these fools. Like, you think that just because McCarran's destroyed one unit, that this is like some kind of great victory? And I thought, good point, right? They are still, by all accounts, losing this war, but they're like, we got one. When your team goes 1-15, right?
Yeah.
He's just like,
if you were 0-14 before that game, that one's a big one.
It's a big one, yeah.
That's what I was about to point out, is that she's so unhinged that she isn't conceptualizing things like, oh, the populace needs morale so that we can continue to carry this war out. And so, like, even though, this is just one event, it's very important to celebrate this, because otherwise we're not going to be able to keep carrying on with this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if there's one thing this chapter will do, is prove that Romano doesn't think like normal people.
She took the villain thing real seriously.
Yeah, she's like sitting there. She's like brushing her hair. Oh, she starts, then she gets mad and like throws the brush against the wall like, these idiots. And she's just in here fuming, right? She's throwing a fit. Oh, I like, she gets thinking about Sen Zhang, right? She's like, I picked the wrong guy. This guy, she's like, he doesn't hate the Free Worlds League as much as I thought he would. He's like, I'm always telling him, let's attack the Free Worlds League. And he's like, that's a bad idea. And I'm like, you're weak, you know? And then she's going nuts. She's like, man, I should have picked Justin. That's who I should have had. And then she kind of fantasizes about Justin coming in and taking her.
But strange, because it's like this power fantasy attached to it, right? It's like, she's like, man, I should have hitched my wagon to Justin's instead, because Sen Shang is a weakling. And it's like, I could have gotten more use out of Justin, which is a messed up thing to think. But then, like, that idea seems to give her sexual arousal in it. And we learn something that we've pretty much already learned, which is that Romano's just completely nuts.
If anyone hasn't seen her, like, official character portrait, they gave her, like, the crazy eyes, right?
She earns them here.
Yeah, they do a really good job. I love her portrait in, like, the Legends book.
Credit to Stackpole, though. I mean, she is a very traditional villain, but he does such a good job of selling the crazy, right? The crazy seems to be attached to trauma from her childhood. Like, it, the more you learn about her, the more you're like, yeah, you're messed up, and but there's like reason for you to be messed up, and like, and you just didn't cope well. And I'm not saying that you become empathetic for her, but you're like, you kind of like, oh man, the whole family's kind of messed up, and you're like this because of that.
She gets to be one of our few examples of like a full mustache twirling villain.
Yeah.
And the thing is all the other villains that we encounter throughout what we've read so far, you can almost take the time to argue yourself into their point of view.
Yes.
But with Romano, you're like, this chapter alone, you're like, I can't even comprehend the way she's thinking.
Well, because there's no logic in it.
Yeah.
It's so very like low vibrational, right? It's this very like, I'm upset with this guy because he couldn't give me what I need, what I wanted from him, and because of that he sucks because he didn't measure up. It's this very base level lizard brain BS.
Yeah, it's hyper emotional with no filter.
Right. And it's all exploitive, right? Her entire context is, even she even gets sexual arousal from the exploitation. It's very, it's a mess. The woman's a mess.
She's a certified freak.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. She's like, she's thinking about, you know, how she killed her stepmother. And then she's thinking about how her stepmother was sleeping with Ridzik. And she's just like, Ridzik. I can't believe I thought about sleeping with Ridzik. Is what, you know, that's she's like, ah.
And this is just another point. She clearly uses like sex as this tool to get what she wants, right? It's very, again, it's such this base level mentality.
I feel sad for her.
Me too.
It does feel like she's kind of like trying to find a target for her anger in her mind. She's this whole, like, paragraph by paragraph, she's like going through people. It's like, I hate Sin. I hate Justin. Duh, I hate him. My stepmother, I hate him. She was sleeping with Ridzik. Oh, I hate Ridzik. Oh, I really hate Ridzik. Ah.
And there's this idea that if she kills these people, right, if she deals with these external threats, that's going to make her insides feel better. That's going to make her happy in here. Of course it won't. Of course it hasn't so far. But that's kind of the psychopathy we're dealing with here.
She does. She feels insulted by Ridzik. That he was like, oh, really? You're just going to go independent? You know, you don't even see us as a threat. You're just going to be like, oh, I'm just chill with Hans now and I'm going independent. And she's like, really? I'll show you, Ridzik.
She's like, I'm going to put the Rid in Ridzik.
Yeah. Oh, and I like, we do get confirmation that he did strike out at the Free Worlds League, which is what, you know, they were talking about on New Avalon. It's like, you know, we should ask him to attack the Free Worlds League. He did it. Arden talked him into it, apparently. That's what she's so insulted by. She's like, oh, really? And now you have enough military force to muster a strike? And like, what do? You attack the Free Worlds League? That's what I wanted to do. You know, you should have helped me. Does anyone want to help me attack the Free Worlds League?
And I think that's a great point, that it's like, she is getting what she wants. It's just not attached to her name. And so the way she's going to deal with that is by putting a plan in motion to kill the person that's doing exactly what she wants.
Yes. That's this is the whole chapter. This is the end. Nothing happens. It's just her. It's just Romano in her room thinking to herself. And at the end, she comes to the conclusion, I'm going to kill Ridzik. My dad tried and it didn't work, but mine will. I'll do it. I'm going to kill him. She apparently decides to order the assassination of Pavel Ridzik again. Let's run it again. Why not? Romano laughed softly as she wove together the final threads in a plot he could never escape. So, you know, he's probably dead. We'll see. I don't know. Her plan, her assassin.
She hasn't been batting well here.
Yeah. It's still a toss up.
But that also wraps up part two. This chapter feels very unhinged through it, but also ratchets down that idea of like, oh, we've still got a complete loose cannon out there.
These chapters all, you know, dealing with all the different successor states, I just can't help but the contrast again is so apparent. Obviously, Romano represents maybe the worst that the Capellans have to offer at this level of governance, right? But, you know, you compare this to Gina's like sacrifice for her duty and subsequently the honor bound story going on between Yorinaga and Morgan Kell. And then we were even joking about Don, Hans, Davion, but all of his guys were working together for this common goal. Again, the contrast between all of these story threads and in between these successor states, it's obvious why some of them are more successful than others, and it's because of stuff like this chapter. Romano literally constantly undermining and working against not only her own efforts, but those of her fellow leaders in the Capellan Confederation.
Well, and I think this chapter closes out with just Romano. Max Liao isn't mentioned.
Right.
No one else is mentioned but Romano. And I think it feels like it's a good foreshadowing that from what we have seen happen to Capellan space so far, is that Romano is almost in control of. She's the one in charge of what's happening in Capellan space. Candace and Justin, they've got one foot out. They're ready to leave, and Romano has steamrolled Max's decision-making. He's listened to her, and Justin was the only one that was talking him out of her plan.
That's a very interesting thing that you've brought this up. Yeah, if Justin is successful in aligning back with House Davion, Romano's what's left whispering in Max's ear.
Well, this chapter lets you think, is she even going to whisper? She's already taken out her stepmom.
Yeah.
Max isn't doing great. There would be no one to stop an ascension.
Right. And I think Candace is first in line, but if she abdicates, then that puts Romano first in line for the celestial throne. And like, nobody wants that, right?
I can't imagine Capellans do.
God, that would be horrible.
It would be real horrible, too, if Hans Davion was able to continue his attack and the Capellan throne crumbled from within.
Termites. It's a very large chair. Ornate.
All that teak.
Yeah, a lot of teak.
With that, we'll have to find out how everyone reacts to everything that's happened so far next week when we continue on to part three of the book we've been working through, Warrior Coupe.
This was another episode of Mechs and Men. I am Kanan Hill, joined as usual by my two friends, Brent and Aaron. We'd like to thank the author, Michael A. Stackpole, and of course, all the other writers and artists who work so hard to keep BattleTech alive. I'd like to thank Catalyst Game Labs for being such generous stewards of the property. We have an email, advice@heat.management. If you have any questions, corrections, concerns, please, advice@heat.management. We're also on social media, Instagram, Twitter, @ofmechsandmen.
You can also find us on the Valhalla Club Discord. The link is in the description of the show, and you can find us and many other of our fellow podcasters in the various booths that make up the Valhalla Club. And usually on Friday nights, you can find us playing either MechWarrior Online or, as of right now, some Helldivers. So come hang out.
Also, please, if you can, feel free to leave a review. Every bit helps. We will return next episode to continue our discussion of Warrior Coupe by Michael A. Stackpole. Until then.
Until next time.
C'est la.